This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Peter Clote, and here's what's coming up.
We did not develop elsewhere. We are not Europeans. We became a people here. We are indigenous to this country, and we are going nowhere.
That was Carly Creel, leader of Africana rights organization AfriForum in South Africa, rejecting U.S. President Donald Trump's offer of asylum on the basis that Afrikaners are being persecuted because of their skin color. Also, the United Nations claims Sudan's paramilitary rapid support forces is blocking aid to the Darfur region, and much of the focus at the African Mining Conference centered on uncertainty about the Trump administration's foreign aid policies. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. A summit of Eastern and Southern African leaders focused on the conflict in Eastern Congo, where M23 rebels threaten the government. Rwandan President Paul Kagame, whose government is accused of supporting the insurgents, attended the summit, while Congolese President Felix Tshisekedi joined virtually. The meeting included members of the East African and Southern African Development Community, or SADC. For more perspective, viewers Paul Indi, who spoke with political analyst Ricky Mukunza for insights.
Joined SADC and East African Community, SADC, which I think was chaired by the Tanzanian president. All these are efforts to get a diplomatic solution to the conflict in DRC. It appears the president of DRC, Felix Tshisekedi, and the president of Rwanda, Paul Kagame, they don't seem to trust each other that much, because you would recall that in the recent SADC East African Community joint summit, Tshisekedi opted to join the meeting virtually, which is not a very good sign in diplomatic terms. Why wouldn't he go and meet, for example, Kagame physically at a meeting and, ventilate issues? But we have also seen how President Paul Kagame is belligerent in terms of how he thinks about the conflict. He tells and Sandra that the conflict is essentially an internal conflict in DRC, where the government is trampling upon the rights of some of its citizens in the eastern DRC. It appears no one wants to find the other so that there can be peace. So it's a very complex matter.
South African troops have been victims who are deployed in the Congo, became victims of this war. They were killed. You've been following these scenarios. You've been following this story. What's your take on whatever is happening in Eastern DRC?
I think it's a very sad story, in the sense that lives have been lost. Property has been destroyed. Livelihoods have been disturbed. We have a number of people who are now in refugee camps because of the situation in Eastern DRC. You spoke about South Africa. South Africa to date has lost around 14 soldiers that died in the war there, being part of the peacekeeping mission of SADC and also of the United Nations. So it's not a case that as Africans we need to celebrate. It's a case that we all need to put our heads together and find a lasting solution to the conflict that exists in that area. We must take into cognizance, Paul, that this conflict is over 20 years old, and something must now give so that peace can be given a chance.
That was Ricky Mukonza, political analyst and professor at Tshwane University of Technology in South Africa, speaking with viewers Paul Indio. The M23 rebel group and its allies have captured most of Goma, the capital of North Kivu province in the Democratic Republic of Congo. In response, the DRC's president says he will mount, quote, a vigorous military response against the rebels. Brigadier General Rose Lopez Kerovori, the director of intelligence at the U.S. Africa Command, warns that Islamist groups are exploiting the security vacuum to expand their activities and radicalize citizens in camps for the internally displaced.
The head of intelligence for the U.S. Africa Command says that over the past 2 years, AFRICOM has supported the peace process in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, trying to move forward with a dialogue to reduce tension between Rwanda and the DRC. However, Brigadier General Rose Lopez Gravori says rapid rebel advances have created a serious situation, particularly in efforts to protect internally displaced persons.
Right now, our concern is, what is the UN doing? Are we being asked for anything by our partners? What can we do to facilitate continued dialogue? I think when you look at the IDP camps, there are 6 million individuals in IDPs in this region that have already been displaced. So when you look at the enormity of the situation and the enormity of so many millions displaced, it's a situation we need to take seriously.
General Kerovori was speaking on a webinar and podcast at the Center for International and Strategic Studies in Washington. She warned that the Islamic State militant group known as ISIS has already taken advantage of the security vacuum created as DRC forces focus on forcefully engaging the M23. That's why AFRICOM is considering how it can ensure that African partners have what they need to combat ISIS and prevent it from exploiting the security vacuum. She says, in every area where the Islamic State or Al-Qaeda militants are active in Africa, it's not because of the popularity of the radical ideology, but rather due to socioeconomic and political reasons.
A lack of governance, a lack of essential services, and the radicalization of groups that have not received that from the governments. And I think West Africa and the rapid expansion of JNIM and Al-Qaeda group there, and ISIS Sahel is really a manifestation of that. So when you have differing ethnic groups and the governments aren't providing the governance, the social services, the education, right, that individuals seek, then they are more easily radicalized, and we have absolutely seen that.
General Kerovori warned that with millions of people displaced now in the DRC, extremist groups will find more opportunities to radicalize and recruit new followers. She says the international community should work to resolve the issues fueling regional wars in Africa. Mohamed El-Shinawi, VOA News, Washington.
On Friday, President Donald Trump issued an executive order inviting white Afrikaners from South Africa to settle in the United States. He accused the African National Congress-led government of unjust racial discrimination against the country's white minority. Trump's claims have led to mixed reactions in South Africa, as Darren Taylor reports.
The U.S. president's order says Pretoria's policies are designed to dismantle equal opportunity in employment, education and business. The ANC's affirmative action laws give preference to black job candidates and to black students applying to university. Its black economic empowerment regulations promote black ownership of large enterprises. The ANC says the policies are necessary to undo the wrongs of apartheid, when whites were favored in all sectors of society. Trump, however, instructed U.S. authorities to offer asylum to Afrikaners on the basis that they are being persecuted because of their skin color. But at a media briefing in Pretoria on Saturday, Kali Krill, leader of Afrikaner rights organization AfriForum, said his people's future is in Africa.
Our people in Afrikaans, the Afrikaner folk, became a people. here on the southern tip of Africa. We did not develop elsewhere. We are not Europeans. We became a people here. We are indigenous to this country and we are going nowhere.
The U.S. President's directive says South Africa's recently passed Expropriation Act enables the state to seize ethnic minority Afrikaners' agricultural property without compensation. Legal experts told VOA that Trump is technically correct, but that stringent conditions within the law and South Africa's strong independent judiciary means a state-led land confiscation campaign is highly improbable. Some parties, including the ANC's coalition partners, are going to court to oppose the act on the basis that it could be used to seize private property. Leader of the solidarity group, Flip Base, agreed with Trump that ANC policies are unfair on white citizens.
We welcome the concern of imported Americans about our situation, but we believe that a solution must be found in South Africa. To put on record, we did not accuse the government of large-scale rice-based land grabs. We did not and will not ask for sanctions against South Africa or that funds for vulnerable people be cut off by the U.S. government.
But Jacques Broederick, who leads a project providing protection to farmers, says the ANC is allowing widespread abuses of white landowners.
AfriForum's 177 neighborhood and farm watch structures countrywide are on the front lines when it comes to facing illegal land invasions regularly. These are not spontaneous acts of desperation. Land grabs are orchestrated and motivated by politicians who profit from this lawlessness. The ANC has over the years created a climate where illegal land grabs are seen as acceptable by some. When property owners seek assistance during land grabs, AfriForum has often seen firsthand how the South African Police Service refuses to take action.
President Cyril Ramaphosa's administration says it's dedicated to protecting private property rights. But Trump's order says the government is fueling disproportionate violence against white landowners. South Africa's violent crime rates are among the highest in the world, with white farmers often victims. But independent studies say no evidence exists of them being targeted any more than other groups. Trump's order also cut an estimated $440 million in annual aid to South Africa, most of it supposed to treat and prevent infectious diseases like tuberculosis and HIV. This, he says, is in response to aggressive actions by South Africa, like accusing US ally Israel of genocide in Gaza and reinvigorating relations with Iran. In a media statement, Pretoria said Trump's order lacks factual accuracy and fails to recognize South Africa's profound and painful history of colonialism and apartheid. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The United Nations today accused Sudan's paramilitary rapid support forces of blocking aid to the famine-threatened Darfur region. Since May, the RSF has besieged North Darfur's El Fasher and attacked displacement camps nearby. The UN resident and humanitarian coordinator in Sudan, Clementine Nkweta Salami, said the persistent restrictions and bureaucratic hurdles imposed by the RSF's humanitarian agency are preventing life-saving assistance from reaching those in desperate need. The French news agency AFP reports the UN is urging simplified bureaucratic procedures and an end to undue interference, including demands for logistical support or mandatory engagement with selected vendors. The UN says famine has been declared in five areas of North Darfur and is expected to spread to five more by May. You are listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Find us on voaafrica.com. There you will find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Sam Nujoma, who led a three-decade-long fight for Namibia's independence from apartheid, has died at age on Sunday. Tributes poured in for the Southern African country's founding father, with South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa crediting Nujoma as an inspiration for his own country's struggle against white minority rule. The French news agency AFP says that in a tribute, Ramaphosa called Nijoma an extraordinary freedom fighter who divided his revolutionary program between Namibia's own struggle against South African colonialism and the liberation of South Africa from apartheid. Namibia's president Nangolo Mbumba said in a statement that our founding father lived a long and consequential life during which he exceptionally served the people of his beloved country. Over his three terms, Nijoma presided over a period of relative economic prosperity and political stability. His policy on AIDS earned some international praise. Nijoma stepped down in 2005, but was still seen as the power behind the throne and did not officially retire from politics for another 2 years. The four-day African Mining in Durban conference has concluded in Cape Town, South Africa. Much of the discussion centered on future investment in Africa's mines from the United States amid the uncertainty about the Trump administration's foreign aid policy. Vicky Stark was at the conference and filed this report.
The new U.S. administration is very interested in developing the mining sector. That's the word from Scott Woodard, who's the Acting Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Energy Transformation at the U.S. State Department. He participated in an onstage discussion about America's interest in Africa's mineral deposits.
One of the executive orders that the president signed on his very first day in the office focuses on minerals, mineral extraction, mineral processing, mainly in the United States. But if you read closely, there are also multiple references in the executive order to international partnerships and, you know, cooperating with partner nations.
Moderator Zainab Usman, director of the Africa Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, asked whether the U.S. understands that in addition to mineral extraction, Africans want projects that add value to the raw material in order to boost the continent's industrialization. Woodard replied that it is early days for the Trump administration, which is still putting together what its specific policies will be. In recent years, America's investment in African minerals needed for cleaner energy has been driven by the Export-Import Bank of the United States. In 2022, the U.S. entered into agreements with the Democratic Republic of Congo and Zambia to establish a supply chain for electric vehicle batteries, underscoring its interest in both countries' copper, lithium, and cobalt resources. The U.S. has also funded the rebuilding of the Lobito Rail Corridor, which will transport minerals from Congo, Zambia, and Angola on the West Coast. Speaking in the exhibition hall, Zambia's Minister of Transport and Logistics, Frank Tayali, thanked the U.S. for its leadership.
As you may be aware, we have something like $350 billion in terms of infrastructure gap financing that the continent needs. Now, this focus on infrastructure development is really key for helping the African economies to be able to improve, so that they're able to look after their people more effectively.
China, meanwhile, is invested in rehabilitating the Tanzania-Zambia Railway Authority, known as TAZARA, that will bolster rail and sea transport in East Africa. And in South Africa, the Indaba's host country, transport and logistics problems at the state-owned Transnet railway system are being seriously looked at. Here's Alan Sekem, head of communications at the Minerals Council of South Africa.
The CEO of Transnet is very open about the state of the railway network, that it needs a lot of work. She was talking multiple billions of dollars to get it back up to normal.
How will they raise the money?
So they are going out on public tenders to try and get that investment in. Also, significantly, they're speaking to their customers, who are, by and large mining companies, to maybe through tariffs, they can invest in the rail network, improve it, and then operate trains themselves, or private train companies can operate trains on the network.
Notably, after years of erratic power supply that hampered the economy, South Africa had managed to keep the electricity on for more than 300 days until just before the start of the mining in Durba. Rolling power cuts started on Friday, January 31st, and ended by 6 a.m. on Sunday, February 2nd. Vicky Stark, VOA News, Cape Town, South Africa.
I have our VOA Sports analyst, Mokbil Yarborough, on ANT today. Thanks for being on the show. How are you, Mokbil?
I'm good, Peter. Thanks for having me.
Big show last night in American football. Super Bowl 59 happened last night, and it was action-packed. As you know, who won, and was this result expected?
Oh, I don't think that the result was expected for many that maybe kind of just watch a little bit, you know. But if you really knew what the Philadelphia Eagles were able to do this year when the full team was healthy, you expected them to really come out with a vengeance. About 2 years ago, the Kansas City Chiefs had beat them in the Super Bowl. That was the first time that quarterback Jalen Hurts was able to make it there. He said he sat in that locker room hours after the rest of the team had left and just sat there and really contemplated how he felt as though he failed his team. Even though he had spectacular numbers and it is a team game, he got back to the same spot against the same opponent. You know, sometimes that revenge tastes so much better against the same team. So going against this team and really putting it to them, beating them 40-22, and 22 points of the Kansas City Chiefs points came in the fourth quarter, meaning that they were unable to score for three quarters. This was massive, a huge win for the Philadelphia Eagles, but I don't think it was expected for anyone outside of Philly.
Well, in the world of football, some shocking games happen in the FA Cup. What were some of the most surprising?
Peter, if we're going to start it off, unfortunately for Liverpool, losing to Plymouth Argyle. This is a team in the championship that is basically in the relegation zone of the championship. And they were able to defeat a team that is at the top of the Premier League and at the top of the Champions League.
Right.
Granted, manager Arne Slot is trying to figure out who he can play. He didn't really have the full A-side team in there, saving some of his key guys for the remaining fixtures of the year. But this was a huge win for Plymouth. A ton of people might not even know this team or have heard of them, and what a huge win it was for them. If we're looking at another game that was a big, big win as well, Aston Villa versus Tottenham, because those are two Premier League teams. Villa was able to win 2-1. Chelsea also went down and lost against Brighton 2-1. So some huge losses. Brighton is still a top team, though. They always find ways to make it challenging for everybody. But the FA Cup is starting to turn into a very, very unique-looking cup this year. A lot of top teams are out, so we'll keep watching.
You either put up or shut up. Well, the NBA All-Star Weekend is coming up. Who are the players to watch?
Yeah, with this new interesting format this year, they have the TNT team, Shaq, Kenny, and Chuck, Charles Barkley, with their own respective teams. For Team Shaq, I don't know how he was able to pull this off, but he somehow has LeBron James and Steph Curry on the same team. So I think those are the two main guys on that team to look at. Team Kenny. Kenny has a younger team in Anthony Edwards and Cade Cunningham, I think, are maybe the two top guys to look at. And then for Charles Barkley's team, Nikola Jokic and Giannis Antetokounmpo, as well as Victor Wembanyama, I think those are the top guys. Yeah, to me, Charles Barkley's team looks the most stacked because he has full team. Pascal Siakam, African Cameroonian, is on that team as well. And Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, who is a potential MVP candidate this year.
Champions League coming up.
Coming up.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Peter Clote in Washington. For all the latest development on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbil Yarborough, and our engineer, Bill Andrade, thanks for choosing The Voice of America. Good evening, Africa.